Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Sujit DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 305, being recorded on the 13th of November, 2019, with special guest Andrew Liu. I'm Sujit, and on Teams I have Evan and a special guest Andrew. And of course, before we get to Andrew, in just a minute, he's back. You know, he's a veteran of the show by now, and he's been on the show before. But before we get to him, talk about all the latest and greatest in the Cosmos DB space. Evan, let's just do a quick roundup on the news. Got a few, I noticed, in your area with the SQL Server. Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah, it's actually it's kind of interesting. It's kind of the modern version of data, right? So a couple things caught my eyes. One, for both MySQL and PostgreSQL, we've got 16 terabytes of data and 20,000 IOPS, right? So this is really ramping up both the storage and the IO capabilities of those SQL DB variants. So definitely a welcome increase, right, in terms of capacity. I think the SQL DB, the kind of the baseline one that's based on SQL Server, I think has been at those levels for quite a while now. So it's good to see that show up on the open source variants as well. The other one, and this is, I didn't even realize this was still a thing anymore, but SQL Server Data Tools projects, like I used to love these when they first came out. They kind of fell out of favor for a little while. It's great to see them come back. SQL Server Data Tools really allows you to do CI/CD, right, for your database, your schema and your data. And we've now added integration for the new SQL Synapse that was released at Ignite, a week or so ago. So great to see kind of, bringing both this modern service and bringing, modern deployment and management capabilities to the tool at the same time.
Absolutely. Yeah, that sounds cool. And then another quick update on Azure HD Insight. In the past, when you spun up an Azure HD Insight cluster, you kind of had to provide the number of nodes, and it was kind of a static number of nodes. Now they've added auto-scaling to it so that you could grow those number of nodes and scale them down. That way you're not consuming too many resources. It becomes a lot more cost-effective. You could, if you have a large volume of data that you have to process, the capacity will automatically expand. And so that's a new feature that they're putting out there for you folks that are using HD Insights. Okay, I think that was it for the updates, right, Evan? Anything else?
It's post-Ignite fatigue, post-Ignite, right? Everybody shipped all their stuff, and now they're resting and recovering.
And one person who is definitely taking a well-deserved rest is Andrew Liu. Andrew, go ahead and introduce yourself to our listeners, and we can get started from there.
Sure. I'm Andrew. I'm a product manager on the Azure Cosmos DB team. And we just got back from the awesome Ignite 2019 conference. We released a bunch of awesome goodies for Azure Cosmos DB, and I'd love to chat with you guys on it.
Yeah. So let's start with, like, what was the vibe like at Ignite this year? I wasn't there, so that's why I'm just getting your input on that.
Oh, it was awesome. Ignite was packed. I think there was around like 35,000 attendees. It was crowded.
Oh my God.
We did lots of sessions, lots of attendees, lots of partying. I love if you guys haven't been to Ignite, I highly recommend it. For the past few years on Thursdays, they actually take you out to Universal Studios as like an after party or post-conference party. It was really great. Lots of great announcements, of course, from a product standpoint too. Azure Arc and Synapse were the two big ones from Azure.
Right. Yeah, those just blew me away when I saw those announcements. But, I'm sure you must have had a ton of people come up to you and kind of just bring to you their questions or concerns about Cosmos DB. What, like, you know, if you were to characterize, what were some of the most popular questions, let's just say, that you heard from the audience?
Sure. I found there's like distinct camps of people. At Ignite, of course, I mean, it's a conference for both developers as well as IT professionals. And within the development crowd, it does skew very heavily to Azure. I mean, there's some selection bias for the folks who came to talk to me, given this is an Azure service that I work on. I would say there's one big camp of people who are already using Cosmos DB a lot. And within that, it typically tends to be like e-commerce workloads, IoT workloads. Within e-commerce, it's a lot of like order processing, real-time recommendations. And on the IoT side, it tends to be a lot of device telemetry. We tend to get, I mean, there's a few top customer asks that we finally were really happy and thrilled to announce completion on. One was aggregation performance and group by. And the other was auto scaling of throughput. That was kind of a common theme that you're seeing with a lot of cloud services. There's also kind of where we wanted to head next, given we see a lot of IoT and other telemetry-based workloads on Cosmos DB, that we've been working on this analytical store that we just released that's tied together, integrated with Azure Synapse and exposed through a set of notebooks. And then, of course, there's a bunch of other quality of life improvements that I'm happy to brief you on. But anyhow, like that's where the center of gravity of a lot of those conversations were on, where a lot of these announcements on both the top asks like aggregation and auto scaling, as well as kind of where we're headed with the Synapse integration. And then camp two, of course, was people who haven't been on Azure before. And of course, I still get the, hey, what is this thing again? Azure seems to have a lot of stuff. Tell me, like, what is all this stuff?
Those are the fun conversations because you get to blow their minds, right? All these things.
Maybe that's a good starting point to level set on. I mean, a lot of the conversations I had were, hey, I used to be on-premise. I used to use SQL Server. In fact, I'm a long-time SQL Server fan. I've been using it for decades. When I move into Azure, you guys throw like a dozen services at me. HD Insight, Cosmos DB, now you have a Synapse thing. How should I think about all this stuff?
Right.
And I think it's a good place to level set in case you guys haven't, played with Cosmos DB or any of these other services before. And the analogy I normally like to use is, look, at Microsoft, if I go back a decade, we used to be, I would make the analogy, we were hammer vendors. We would build a hammer and we'd tell you every problem was a nail. That hammer is SQL Server and all of your problems are nails, just whack it down. And if it looked not like a nail, just whack it down harder. And trust me, hammers are very effective.
Eventually it'll go down, right?
Eventually it'll go down. The approach we took with Azure was to build a toolbox as opposed to a hammer. And that way, if you had a screw, you should pick up a screwdriver. If you have a nail, you should pick up your trusty hammer. But basically, no matter what your problem is, you're now enabled to pick the right tools for the right job. That's kind of the overall theme. And the main thing you notice when you move into a cloud world is, hey, I can no longer scale up by buying really expensive, big, beefy scale-up machines, right? Like if I need more IOPS or I need more storage, just buy a bigger machine, buy a bigger drive, add more CPUs to your machine. Now you have to scale out, right? Like we give you here's a set of VM SKUs, choose these set of VM SKUs. And unfortunately, when you're looking at scaling, you hit a glass ceiling on what happens when you hit the biggest, baddest, VM SKU, right? How do you grow to infinite IOPS, for example? And we have a really good way of doing that. We have a cloud platform, right? You can very easily spin up more computers. And so if you've been around the relational databases long enough, you know this problem must scale out. If you want more data volume, you want more write throughput, you would shard the database. And likewise, if you wanted to get more read throughput and higher availability, you would replicate the database. But this always came at like some challenges. Like if I have, let's say, a dozen shards replicated three ways, doing little things like application development, I want to, let's say, add a new attribute. You had to do these migration scripts like alter tables, create index, and deploying that across a dozen shards times three replicas. Meanwhile, the business is telling you, hey, by the way, you can't lose availability. There's no maintenance period. You always have to be online. Well, those posed as strong technical challenges for you to solve. So what we did was we built a set of scale-out technologies where if you were to go back to the drawing board and say, you know what, when we built SQL many decades ago, we were in the scale-up race, right? Like even CPUs were in the scale-up race. How many gigahertz can we scale out from scale up on a single CPU core? Can we get 1 gigahertz? Can we get 2 gigahertz? Can we get 3 gigahertz? But if I move fast forward, it's all about scale out. How do I effectively and very easily deploy across a cluster of machines? And that is the premise behind SQL Data Warehouse, HDInsight, Databricks, Cosmos DB, is these are all a set of scale out technologies. And as you scale out, we can think about the problems different ways. Like it's not just a one size fits all approach. Like if I have a big cluster of machines, do I want to run a very small number of computationally expensive queries and therefore devote all of my CPU on just a handful of like 1 or 2 queries? That might be useful for a team of, you know, BI analysts. Or if I'm building a big e-commerce website, as I modernize and move from brick and mortar to e-commerce, how do I scale out to many, many concurrent users and maintain predictability of performance and availability for that? In that case, when you scale out to large clusters of machines, rather than devoting all of your CPU and memory and physical resources for a few requests, you're trying to be very frugal by dividing up very, very small amount of physical resources per request such that you can handle many of them concurrently. And that's the approach, of course, that we took with Cosmos DB is if you're building systems that require very, very high throughput, very, very low latency, these tend to be things like systems where you're doing a lot of ingest. This is the telemetry use case that we keep seeing, or systems where you need a lot of low latency and high availability. These tend to be customer-facing applications that this is how we think about Cosmos DB. It's our scale-out NoSQL database as a service.
Now, when you talk about scale-out, I know you briefly kind of mentioned about this auto-scaling feature that was recently announced. Can you just talk about that? I know that comes up a lot.
Oh, yeah. So as a user coming into Cosmos DB, you'll notice we abstract away the physical resources like nodes, CPUs, memory, IOPS into a single currency called request units. And it's actually, that's one of my next frequently asked questions is like, hey, you just introduced this new thing. What is this again? And the goal there was no one really knows how to manage or how to equate, let's say if I'm growing a workload from 1,000 requests per second to 2,000 requests per second, how many gigabytes of RAM is that? And that's always been kind of the dark art, which is for scaling a solution, what you would do is you go, well, I'd profile it. I'm at 1,000 requests per second now. If I want to hit 2,000 requests per second, what historically I would do is go, oh, seems like memory is my bottleneck right now. Throw some memory at the problem and then run a benchmark test. How much? I don't know. Just throw some at it. Benchmark it and see if I hit my target. And if I didn't hit my target, maybe it's like CPU became the next bottleneck. So what we'll do is we'll add more CPU and you'll rinse repeat until you hit your performance target. With request units, what we did wanted to do was bring this into a single dimension so you're not playing whack-a-mole, and then also make that a logical charge so that if you know that your requests on average take 5 request units, having 1,000 of them at any given time just means 5 request units per operation times 1,000 operations per second equals 5,000 request units per second. And if I wanted to double that to 2,000 requests per second, 5 times 2,000 is 10,000 request units per second. It makes this big whack-a-mole and iterative process that used to take weeks into something that you can do mental math over. But just because we made this mental math and easy doesn't mean that it's as easy as we want it to be. The next challenge is, hey, Microsoft just introduced a new abstraction over me. I know the intention was to simplify things. However, it turns out people aren't really used to managing how many RUs they have provisioned. Sometimes I have workloads that, let's say if I'm building a line of business application, it's hot from hours 9 to 5. And the old school way of doing things, like if you're doing like boxes or VMs is, well, it really doesn't matter because scaling number of boxes is hard when you have stateful services. It's easy when things are stateless, like your AKS or your app service. But the thing is that like databases are stateful. So historically what you would do is you go, you know what, just set it and forget it. Just go and buy a VM or a box that fit your workload and just keep it on 24/7, 365. maybe once a year you'll do a scaling exercise like every Q4. But that's not the ideal way to use Cosmos DB. Cosmos DB allows you to scale up and down on demand without any loss of availability. We can do these completely online. But people weren't doing it, and they weren't leveraging the full capability of the system to really optimize and make this a really cost-efficient solution. And so that's what AutoScale is all about. Sorry, this is kind of a long-winded way to get here. But basically, if at this period of time you need 10,000 RUs, we'll scale to 10,000 RUs. This next period of time you need 1,000 RUs, we'll scale it down to 1,000 RUs. Our billing happens hourly, so that's kind of how you want to think about our auto-scaling solution in terms of cost savings and granularity. We do, of course, react faster. We're not going to go and rate limit requests if you need more RUs until you hit a max threshold. And the max threshold really there is to give you predictability, so that way the flip side of auto-scale is always like, hey, if I hit the front page of Reddit and I get a ton of traffic, will this become... Well, this is auto scale infinitely and become expensive. No, it won't. What we'll do is our auto scale solution, we call it autopilot containers and autopilot databases. As you set a max threshold on RUs, and then we automatically scale up to that max and down to only a tenth of that minimum. And based off of the traffic we observe, we immediately scale up and down to fit your traffic curve very, very tightly.
So this is interesting. So it sounds like I want to go back to kind of why what you said about why y'all built this. Is you built it because you saw people weren't taking advantage of the scaling capabilities. So in essence, we built a way to save customers money, even if it costs us money, right? To some extent, right? Like that's on the one side. On the other side, obviously, if they need the traffic, they're no longer gonna get the performance. Or the negative performance of the performance degradation that if they didn't have the auto scale, they would get, right? Somebody wasn't watching it, they would get it, right? I mean, am I kind of following that, right? Like you basically built this feature because customers were hurting on either side, either not getting the performance they needed or paying us for more than they really did. And you built the feature to allow them to optimize that.
Yeah, I think a lot of where I saw this is this whole like, hey, you've provisioned too much or too little problem. Right. All stems from, look, organizations are complex. And ultimately, when you're building your own application at home, you are accountable for both the functionality, the performance, and the cost. But when you're in an enterprise environment, you're often told like, hey, your manager or leadership will take care of the bill. You need to functionally deliver, right? Or if you're doing this as a professional services, your customer is the one who's going to foot the cloud bill, but you have a statement of work where you need to functionally deliver. And so what happened is people were really good on building functional apps on Cosmos DB, but from a cost management perspective, there was always this like Alice built the app and is functionally complete, but Bob is paying the bill. And yep. It's mysterious as to, hey, how is my bill high and how do I manage this? But that wasn't in the scope of work for Alice, and Alice wasn't always like held accountable for it. And so this is kind of where we saw this like mismatch. And hey, the people building the apps weren't always the people paying the bills. And so with Autopilot, what this does is it gives you actually a really easy way out on solving this problem, where you can say, you know what, Alice, don't worry too much about having to manage the RUs as you try to get something that's functionally complete. In fact, you set it on auto scale, set it and forget it. Microsoft has actually done a very good job of implementing automatic scaling to keep things both performing as well as optimizing on cost. You just focus on the functionality. And that's kind of the intent behind this.
And Andrew, the way I know, like in the typical case, if you exceed your RUs, you start getting these 429 kind of errors, and then you have to retry. So is that what you guys are catching and then automatically increasing the RUs there?
Yes, and that's the beautiful thing is historically people would build exactly what you just said, is they would do either exception handling, waiting for the 429 and increasing RUs, or by monitoring the metrics, which of course is near real time, is not actually real time. There's some latency behind it. By baking this into the service itself, we can actually preempt that. Like instead of telling you, hey, here's a 429 for your workload, or we're rate limiting your workload, instead what we can do is go, oh, We know how to handle that. Instead of telling you, hey, you've exceeded your rate limit, we just bump up the RUs right there and then and allow the request to go through. So this happens very instantaneously and seamlessly. And likewise, when we detect, hey, there's no traffic here, you have all these RUs that are just left over, let us scale down. We can do so when we detect that things are quiet. And so this happens a lot more seamlessly. And from a user experience perspective, you don't have to wait for a 429 before scaling up. Instead, our goal is to tell you, no, we'll never tell you 429. We'll just scale up. But we also will responsibly scale down to help save on cost, because realistically, your traffic is spiky. And of course, from a cost management perspective, we also give you the ability to set a max threshold so that way, if like unexpected things happen, like you land front page of Reddit for your hobby application, you don't end up with a really expensive bill either. You can cap it, of course.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
The most friendly way possible.
I know you also mentioned about the group buy feature that you seemed excited about. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Oh, sure. This has been one of the top asks for a while now on Cosmos DB. It turns out when you move from a scale-up to a scale-out model, there's a set of query functionality that historically you would lose in the NoSQL space. And if I go back like a full decade, early NoSQL systems were largely like these big distributed hash tables, and queryability was fairly minimal. And if I look at the past 10 years of innovation in terms of scale-out databases, is bringing back all of that queryability that you had lost when you had used systems like HBase. Like, for example, HBase is a dumb key value store. It's great when you want to go access a record by the primary key. It's terrible when you want to query anything else. So how do we bring queryability back to scale-out databases was the problem to solve. And secondary indexing, for example, evolved us a long way in terms of like, oh, find me things on other attributes. Maybe I want to do, I've keyed on a user ID, but I want to search off of an email address instead. One of the bigger challenges is how do you do things like aggregation? And historically with Cosmos DB, what our users would have noticed is we've approached this like iterative crawl, walk, run on aggregation, where we got functionally complete on aggregation, but the RU charges were sometimes higher than what you wanted, and the latency was also a bit higher than what you wanted. We've been working on a lot of our backend on our indexing technology, on improving the indexing layout and pushing those aggregates way down again onto the index layer. Some of the neat challenges in the scale-out space is how do you do this across shards, right? So each shard can tell you and look at its index like, oh, I have a sum, or I have a account, or a min, max, whichever aggregate, and tell you what it is within the shard. But basically, you also have to do this cross-partition logic on, hey, if I'm looking across five different database shards, my sum would actually be a sum of sub-sums, right? Anyhow, this is the kind of stuff that we've been baking into our query engine, and over time, also improving our indexing layer on the efficiency of our ability to push this down deep into the back end and then do minimal post-processing of those results, that we're actually in a really happy state now. Aggregates, you'll notice that latency is a lot better, RUs are a lot better, and then from a group by perspective, this is the new thing on the block that we've also reintroduced this back into scale-out databases.
Now, this doesn't circumvent the whole cross-partition thing, right? We still have to keep that in mind when we're making our queries.
Yes. We can change the physics of the system, but right, we can make it from an easy-to-develop perspective, make this easier and easier to develop against. I still encourage, of course, all of our users to take in mind like their data model, their partitioning strategy. These are inherent physics of is your data located on machine one? Is it located on machine two? Can we efficiently route queries to a minimal set of machines without having to search across all of them? Like, these kind of aspects, of course, still play an important role.
But I think what you're talking about, Andrew, is trying to take, it goes back to what you were saying in the beginning when you talked about, the effort involved with dealing with sharding and everything. Like, I was involved with some of the early sharded applications that were running on Azure, and it was nightmarish. Right. I mean, I worked with a customer that I think had 1,000 different shards. It was just crazy, right? The code that we had to write and doing upgrades, all that kind of stuff. I mean, you still have to be a little bit aware, but you're trying to reduce the awareness that the end user, that the developer has to have of that
correct
construct. Right, make it smaller and smaller so they get the benefit without the complexity, right?
Yeah, if I were to try to highlight and break, decompose all of the work you're doing, there's a set of design time work and there's a set of runtime work, right? The design time work is really just choosing a clever sharding strategy so that you optimize your placement of data according to your data access patterns. And then there's the runtime work, which is actually routing the requests, rebalancing the shards, being able to run this like cross-partition logic. What Cosmos DB has done is all of the runtime things that you had to think about before, we've solved all of that. But from a design time perspective, we still want to think about choosing a clever design.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's always been the hard part, right? Because once you're at runtime, you really don't have a whole lot of control, right?
Right.
Design time, you can really, if you invest the effort up front, right, it pays off later.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Go ahead.
I figured the other really interesting thing that we had announced was the analytical store. I figure I'd also kind of give you an idea of where we're headed with that. The short summary of this is we keep seeing people use Cosmos DB and analytics solutions because of the ingest, and it's able to ingest very quickly, as well as it acts really well as a serving layer for programmatic access to data, especially if it's high concurrency, low latency type of access. But what we saw is people used to build these big data pipelines, right? You basically have a transactional store like Cosmos DB and an analytical store, a cold store, like a hot store, cold store pattern. And on the cold store side, you'd use something like Azure Data Lake so that you can park some data for really long periods of time that remain dormant or cold and are really optimized for scans as opposed to indexed query. And that's what makes it so cost effective is you're optimizing for the coldness of that data and really optimizing for batch processing. And historically what people would do is they would use Cosmos DB plus Data Lake, in which your ingest comes into Cosmos DB and then you use the change feed and the data retention feature to replicate and prune that data from Cosmos DB and then land that for long-term retention in a data lake, right? Because we keep seeing this pattern over and over and over again, we also thought maybe we can make this easier for our users to set this up. And so what we've done is we've built our an internal cold store where we can already do this tiering of hot data and cold data. And if you want to say like hot data is last 30 days, cold data last 3 years, let's say, for example, what you can do is you can set up independent data retention knobs on our hot store and our cold store. And what was really novel about this is we've also optimized the layouts on both. So our hot store is done in a row format. It's optimized for queries that look like select star from this container where first name is Andrew. Whereas the analytical store or the cold store, we keep referring to the analytical store, is we actually store it in a column layout. Because when you're doing batch processing, if you're doing something like, hey, take the average of the temperature from the sensor telemetry and maybe group by a few different dimensions, what you'll notice is that reading the entire row is very inefficient because you're only looking at one column or property of that record, right? You're just looking for the temperature to perform an average or some percentile math on. And so if you do this on a column-oriented layout, when you do this batch processing that scans through everything, you get much more efficient IOPS, or rather for the same amount of IOPS, you get much more efficient reading of information if you do it in a column layout. And so what we do is we live replicate from a hot store in row format into a column store in our cold store. And that way, you get great performance isolation between your transactional and analytical workload. B, you have these optimized in a cost-effective way for both transactions and analytics. And then C, this is all hands-off. You don't have to build anything as a developer. No ETL required. Like, we're just doing live replication. And what we do is we expose this analytical store with this awesome new product that we just launched, Azure Synapse. So then that way you can use Azure Synapse as a scale-out compute layer that does all of the actual compute for your analytics. But that reaches down into Cosmos DB as a linked service, such that you can go and grab and run their analytics on top of all the telemetry that you've ingested into your Cosmos DB scale-out store. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I didn't realize we were going to get a Synapse overview as part of the Cosmos DB overview, but that's great to see the interaction. I didn't realize the two were that intimately tied, but it makes total sense.
Yeah. These things go together like peanut butter and jelly.
Now, you know, an update that we talked about recently, Andrew, was the cool notebook feature that you guys released. What was kind of motivation for doing something like that?
Yes. So this is then the last mile of what I just presented with analytical store on Cosmos DB integrated Synapse. What we're commonly seeing is historically with Cosmos DB, we built all around SDKs to empower software engineers. But there's a whole different tool chain if you're a data scientist, right? Like you're probably using Jupyter notebooks. You're loading everything into Python, into data frames. You're using tooling like scikit-learn or pandas to do processing of those data frames and to do data sciences over that, right? And so what we wanted to do was also build an interface that is a lot more productive and that caters to doing data sciences over all of the telemetry that you're ingesting in Cosmos DB. And so what we've done is we've built a built-in notebook interface so that when you go into Cosmos DB and you open up the portal Data Explorer, we actually embed our own notebooks where you can run things like visualization and all of your favorite Python notebooks. And what's really cool about that is it's then one single pane where our notebook can then call into things like Synapse if you're running a scale-out compute job over your data in Cosmos DB, or it can talk directly into the Cosmos DB as well in terms of performing queries. So that if you want to go and just pick out, let's say, you know, a few bits and pieces of data, let's say the telemetry you've ingested, and go and plot that using tooling like Boca or Plotly and visualize that. It gives you a really, you know, easy to use interface for doing so.
And you're using all the same familiar Python libraries and code and whatnot, right, to do all this?
Yep. Our whole intent is rather than coming up with yet another set of proprietary tech that you have to learn, we dock onto open source technologies. That's kind of the modus operandi for us. And lucky, we realize rather than force you to learn a new thing, we'll come and meet our users where they are. If this is the common tooling that they're using, then that's what we attach to. And then with the notebooks, you can do, you know, same things here. You've always been familiar. We let you use pip to do a pip install of whichever Python libraries you're already using. We actually preload the Cosmos DB SDKs also, so that if you want to do shorthand queries and load that into a data frame and then do some processing via pandas or any of these other libraries, it just makes it really, really, you know, productive to do this.
Right. And so you could do the same thing if you had like Anaconda or something like that on your own local machine, I take it.
Yes.
Yeah. Awesome. Now, has there been any work in, you mentioned IoT, and I've been doing some work with IoT recently, especially with regards to time series databases. Where does Cosmos DB fit in, you know, in that world?
Got it. I think it's complicated because we see a lot of different scenarios and there's a lot of overlap. Most time series databases are optimized also for write ingest, just like Cosmos DB. And they rely on the fact that, hey, because we know it's time series data, we can make certain optimizations on how we ingest that data. I would say that Cosmos DB isn't a time series database per se, like precisely, but it gets used a lot in overlapping scenarios. We use a lot of the same techniques on the underlying store. Specifically, Cosmos DB is a log structured store underneath that's optimized for a high amount of write ingest. And so as a result, a lot of the telemetry workloads that we do see coming into Cosmos DB tend to be time series data and ingest it really quickly. And then we also have a set of functionality that's really valuable in the time series space. Specifically, most of the type of reads after you've ingested that data in the time series space is doing things like aggregation over by binning periods of time, right? Like, hey, what is the average temperature or max temperature of this set of temperature sensors for each minute granularity. And so this is typically done through a set of stream processors. And what Cosmos DB does is we actually expose that log that we have ingested into Cosmos DB via our change feed. And what we commonly see people do is they do stream processing, whether that's Spark structured streaming or Azure Stream Analytics, on the by tailing the change feed, the log that's coming into Cosmos DB to produce these kind of aggregates. I find this is typically where we see this overlap. And if this is the scenario, I think it's actually a really great fit, since we scale out really quite well for ingesting an arbitrary amount of data and then surfacing it back out. But yeah, if there are other scenarios, those are actually things that I'm, you know, I'll be honest, I'll put where my domain knowledge ends is outside of this context. And I'd actually like to hear from our users. Is there a place where they can comment or send feedback? I'd actually like to learn from others, like what are they up to as well?
We'll put your email address on the site. They can know you directly.
No, they can leave. I'm sure our listeners can leave queries on our podcast feed, Twitter feed, and we'll certainly forward it to you.
Come on, I want to blow up his email. I want to blow up his
inbox. Hi, come on. He's still recovering from Ignite. Forget it.
I'm okay with it. I mean, if people want to reach out, my email address is lou.andrew@microsoft.com. Lou is spelled L-I-U. You know, I love it. I love it when people reach out to me.
Awesome. Thank you. That's great. Some great updates. What else have you, like anything else that you think was announced at Ignite that might be worth talking about here, Andrew?
Those were the big things. We did have a long laundry list of other small improvements, including SDK updates, PowerShell commandlets, ARM improvements, AZ CLI improvements. But I mean, it's a pretty long laundry list. I won't bore you too much about those. I think maybe a few of the highlights, from a highlights perspective, if you're security conscious, one of the things that the Azure networking team has been working on is Azure private endpoints. This is to help you connect your Azure VNet into on-premise through like a VPN. Azure Cosmos DB, we're happy to announce that we've finished our integration with private endpoints. So you can now set up your Cosmos DB, expose it through Azure private endpoint. And then that way, when it's if you're VPNing into your VNet, you can connect from an on-premise machine to your Cosmos DB via that private endpoint.
And the That's other huge. Is, That's huge.
You're talking yes. the private link.
Maybe I'm downplaying
right?
private endpoints too much.
You're talking the private link capability, right?
That was, yes.
We just had somebody on the show not too long talking about. That's a super powerful feature.
The context behind that is we've had different ways on how we've implemented our virtual network, right? Typically, you'd hear terms like service injection or service endpoints. Mm-hmm. And service injection is services that deploy on virtual machines like HD Insight and Databricks. Databricks team doesn't really have to build VNet integration per se. What they need to do is just make sure that they're deploying on a VNet-enabled virtual machine when they deploy the Spark job or Hadoop job that you're running. There's also a set of things called service endpoints. This is how PaaS-to-PaaS connectivity happens within our virtual network. It's actually based off of signature-based authentication schemes in which we sign every request flowing between these services with a signature that belongs to your virtual network. And then we ACL it on the service side, on the receiving side too, and verify, hey, if this is a packet that's been signed by this VNet, accept the request, otherwise reject the request. The problem with this approach has always been, how do I expose this to my, let's say, on-premise development machine, or if I have an on-premise application that needs to connect into a service endpoint, it doesn't know how to do this signature authentication. And so what private endpoint does and private link does is we disable the public DNS entries for the service itself, for the service endpoint that you have. And then we expose it internally within the VNet and attach it to a private IP address that is only visible from within that virtual network. And so that way, if you're doing local development and you're VPNing in and you're trying to connect to your Cosmos DB or something of that nature, you can do so by tunneling that through the private link, and then that'll access all of your different PaaS services within the virtual network.
Yep, we had to deal with the IP address firewalling before, and now we could just make it completely internal.
Yeah, we can make this much, much more seamless.
Awesome. This has been some great updates, Andrew. Thank you so much for taking the time. Andrew, I mean, Evan, anything else you think
No,
we should?
this is great. This just reinforces every time Andrew comes on or we talk about Cosmos DB, I keep saying I need to go spend some time with it. I need to go spend some time with it. It just reinforces my belief that it's kind of the where it's at going forward on some of the new application design.
And I need to fire. You need to fire up those Jupyter notebooks and start doing some queries.
My list is long. We had a day of learning in my team today, and I decided I was going to learn AKS. So I deployed my first AKS cluster and my first containerized application. So, I'm getting there.
All right, Andrew. Thanks so much for taking the time again. And yeah, if you have any links that you want to share with us, send them over to me and I'll put them in the show notes as along with the recording. All right.
Awesome. Thank you so much, guys.
Great. Thanks, Andrew.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.